Hello and welcome to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. And in these last few days of the year, we're going to look back on an incredible celestial event. Every so often, the planet Venus does something remarkable. It transits between the Earth and the Sun. From Earth, it appears as a black dot, slowly moving across the disk of the Sun. The phenomenon has occurred only 6 times since the invention of the telescope. This year, Venus made its 7th recorded transit and the last for this century, and it was watched by millions. Today, we're going back through space-time to discover why the transit has held such a fascination. Producer Ros Bluett finds out what has compelled astronomers to often risk everything to record this mesmerising event since the first sighting at the beginning of the 17th century.
One Sunday in late 1639, in the village of Much Hool, near Liverpool, England, Jeremiah Horrocks set about preparing for a great event, the first transit of Venus across the face of the Sun ever to be observed by human beings.
It was the 24th of November, 1639, and he had predicted 24th of November, 1639, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the sun in November was going down at around 4 o'clock. So he had a very, very narrow window. And when 3 o'clock came, the sky was very cloudy. And I just can't imagine what he was feeling.
Sitting warm, wrapped with delight.
Horrocks arranged a telescope so that it projected the sun's image onto a piece of paper in a darkened room. The image was 6 inches wide. The size of his room did not allow for anything larger. And on the piece of paper, he divided the circumference into degrees and the diameter into 30 equal parts.
And he must have watched and watched and watched the skies. But at 3:15, amazingly, the cloud dispersed. And he had half an hour when the light from the sun came through his telescope, was projected onto the sheet that he'd set up in the room. And if he looked at the little disk of the sun projected onto that sheet, he could just see this tiny, tiny black dot moving across the face of the sun. Which is an amazing thing. This is the first person ever to see a planet move.
From the early to the modern astronomers, the transit of Venus has held a mesmerising grip, as well as providing a key to unlocking further information about the heavens. Since the invention of the telescope in the early 17th century, there have been 6 opportunities to observe the transit of Venus, 1 pair per century. In today's program, we'll take a look at these past viewings, who watched, what they witnessed, and how they captured this prized celestial event.
There it is.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Can I have a look, please?
Yep.
Okay, now, no, I can't quite...
Right in the middle of the arc, you can see, Nick.
Right in the middle of the arc. Okay, so I'm looking through quite a reasonable-sized telescope. I can't say that I can... Oh, yes, I can. Yes, I can. Yes, there it is. There's a nice little indentation on the edge of the sun.
Venus is the second planet from the sun, one closer to the sun than the Earth. It's about the same size as the Earth. It has a rocky surface like the Earth, and it has an atmosphere like the Earth. But there the similarities end. Its atmosphere is almost entirely made of carbon dioxide. We'd suffocate if we went there and stepped out of our spacecraft. Its atmospheric density is about 90 times the air density that we feel at the Earth's surface. And the temperature down on the surface is close to 500 degrees Celsius. Not only that, but there's sulfuric acid clouds in the top of Venus's atmosphere. So, although it's named after the goddess of love and beauty, it's in fact a very good incarnation of hell.
Assistant curator at Sydney Observatory, Andrew Jacob. And as two transits of Venus occur 8 years apart, then not again for over a century, both he and fellow astronomer Nick Lom were born at a fortuitous time. Nick has since made the transit one of his major areas of study.
There's such a lot of history behind transits of Venus. They're not that spectacular to look at, but there's just so much history, so many people have put so much effort into observing transits. And I think if you remember some of those people, it makes transits very, very exciting and significant.
Copernicus,
Kepler,
Jeremiah Horrocks,
Tycho Brahe,
Galileo,
Edmund Halley,
Isaac Newton,
Neville Mascal,
Chapdeau Taroche,
James Cook,
Charles Mason and Jeremiah Dixon.
According to science historian Peter Orton, it all began with Nicholas Copernicus at the end of the 15th century. This became regarded as the starting point of modern astronomy.
We all know that it wasn't until Copernicus that the Sun was put at the centre of the solar system, in the centre of the world. And in the 16th century, Galileo, as you know, was persecuted by the church for teaching that the Earth moved around the Sun. It wasn't until the century after that that astronomers began to realise that Galileo was right.
Galileo, in just after 1610, observed Venus with a telescope. It was the first time anyone had observed the planets with a telescope. And when he looked at Venus, he saw that Venus had phases, like the Moon. Sometimes it was a full disk, sometimes it was a crescent shape. And to Galileo, that showed that there was another object in our solar system, which was orbiting not the Earth, but the Sun directly. Kepler, in about 1618, introduced his third law of the way the planets move around the Sun. Kepler's third law related the time a planet takes to go around the Sun to the distance of the planet from the Sun. And it was a particular relationship which held for all the planets. Kepler predicted from his laws and the Rudolphine tables of planetary motions that he produced that Venus would transit across the face of the Sun in 1631, but he missed the 1639 transit. It was Jeremiah Horrocks, looking through the Rudolphine tables of Kepler, who realised, with just a month to spare, that in 1639 there'd be a second transit of Venus.
The Transit of Venus, 1639.
Now, the very first person to witness a transit of Venus across the face of the Sun was the brilliant astronomer Jeremiah Horrocks. He was the first person in England to appreciate the laws of Kepler.
Kepler had theories about planetary motion, which obviously are quite difficult to prove without leaving the planet, but you can prove them by observing when planets move in relation to each other. And he had predicted points at which Venus and Mercury, in fact, would transit the Sun and you would be able to observe them. Although his theories were right and although everything that he predicted was correct, his maths was wrong. And he predicted that when Venus transited the Sun in 1639, it would do so at a high orbit, so you wouldn't be able to see it. It wouldn't really pass between us and the Sun. Although it passed between Earth and the Sun, it didn't pass in a way that would be visible. And the very, very, very young and very humble Jeremiah Horrocks looked at Kepler's mathematics and Landsberg's tables and thought, that maths is wrong. He did the maths again and came up with the idea that in 1639, we would actually be able to observe the transit of Venus. It would pass across the sun in such a position that you would be able to see it. So he had to wait for it to happen to see if he was right.
I then beheld a most agreeable spectacle, the object of my most sanguine wishes, a spot of unusual magnitude and of a perfectly circular shape, which had already fully entered upon the sun's disk on the left, so that the limbs of the sun and Venus were precisely coincided, forming an angle of contact. Not doubting that this was really the shadow of the planet, I immediately applied myself sedulously to observe it.
Jeremiah Horrocks' astounding observation, coupled with his short life, he died at the age of 22, has preoccupied fellow Liverpudlian and writer Frank Cottrell Boyce for many years.
A kid in his teens from nowhere, with no backing at all, realised that Kepler was wrong, which is kind of amazing. It's like saying, you know, it's like a A-level student saying Stephen Hawking is wrong and I'm going to fix it. This is what kind of really inspires me. As a young man, he'd realised that there was going to be a transit of Venus that would be visible in 1639, which was a few years hence.
He knew that if he could measure the times of entry and the times of exit, he could use it to make an estimate of what we call the astronomical unit, the distance between the Earth and the Sun. He'd be able to eventually not only get the distance from the Earth to the Sun, but the distance of every planet from the Sun. He would be mapping out the universe for the first time at the proper scale.
So Horrocks used both his measurement of the transit of Venus and a transit of Mercury, which happened to have occurred in the same year, to estimate a distance between the Earth and the Sun, which is the whole reason for looking at transits, of course. And his estimate in our modern value is about 191 million kilometres. And that's an extremely good value, really. It's only perhaps just under 1.5 times our modern value. It's not 10 times or 20 times out. It's actually reasonably close to that value. So it was a great step forward. So given Horrocks's short notice and the very limited equipment that he had, just a telescope in a darkened room and a piece of paper he was making marks on, that was a huge advance for that time. He did a great job with the limited equipment that he had.
Jeremiah Horrocks' observations pushed our understanding of the solar system in the right direction. But there was still a way to go to get accurate figures. 75 years later, in the early 1700s, Edmund Halley, who later had a comet named after him, captured the imagination of scientists when he published his famous paper outlining how a more exact measurement might be calculated.
In 1716, the British astronomer Edmund Halley wrote an essay predicting the transit and saying, we need to see this. It's really, really important in order to calculate the distance between Earth and Sun. And this would only work if as many observers as possible would view the transit from as many locations as possible, as far apart as possible.
I recommend it, therefore, again and again to those curious astronomers who, when I am dead, will have the opportunity of observing these things and diligently apply themselves with all their might in making this observation.
Frozen plains and tropical seas. The transit of 1761.
You know, by the time of the next transit, it's widely predicted, and, you know, the British Empire is mapping the world and they're sending, you know, great navigators and scientists all over the world to observe this. And you've got the, I would say, the operators of a state, but are the operators of an entire empire watching the next one.
Right.
The 1639 transit had been witnessed by only two observers. The next one, in June 1761, would be a complete contrast. In the years leading up to it, over 100 teams of astronomers in Europe began to make preparations to observe it from a variety of far-flung places. This piece of astronomical history would not be allowed to pass unnoticed.
For the astronomers in the 18th century, the transit of Venus really held the key for one of the most pressing astronomical scientific questions of their age, which was the size of the solar system.
History writer Andrea Wolfe has developed a fascination with the personal stories of the 18th century science explorers.
They knew the relative distances between the planets. So they knew that, for example, Jupiter was five times further away from the Sun as Earth, or they knew that Venus was 0.28 of the length between Sun and Earth. So they had no idea how long this distance actually was. So it's almost like having a map without the scale to it.
Once they had one distance, the distance from the Earth to the Sun, they could then estimate the various distances from the Earth to the different planets. So it was of crucial importance, and that's why so many expeditions were sent out to observe both 18th century transits.
They intended to use the transit of Venus almost like a celestial yardstick to find out the distance between Earth and Sun, which would then provide all the distances in the solar system. So it's this incredibly exciting kind of quest. It's like the holy grail of astronomy, really, they are looking for there.
So in 1761, well over 100 astronomers prepared to view the transit, many undertaking extensive and harrowing journeys. One remarkable story was that of the two Englishmen, Charles Mason and Jeremiah Dixon, who later became known for their surveying work in America.
Mason and Dixon were asked by the British Royal Society to travel to Bengkulu on the island of Sumatra for the 1761 transit. And literally 4 days after they've left the British coast, they're still in the English Channel, they get attacked by a French boat. This is during the Seven Years' War. Their boat gets attacked, gets absolutely shattered. There are people dead, people almost fatally wounded. So the captain decides to go back to England to get the ship repaired. And Mason and Dixon, they write to the Royal Society and say, actually, we're never going to make it to Sumatra. Can we just kind of watch the transit of Venus from a location in the Mediterranean? And the Royal Society see this as mutiny. So off they go after the boat is repaired. And when they stop at Cape Town, they decide that there's no point going back on the boat because they're never going to make it to Sumatra in time. And it turned out that their observation was the best observation in the southern hemisphere for the first transits.
The main aim of the exercise of observing the transits of Venus was to time the contacts, and those timings are the crucial ones. And Mason and Dixon made those timings accurately.
The first of these timings is recorded when the edge of Venus first makes contact with the Sun. The second timing is taken when the whole of Venus has just made it onto the Sun's disk. The third is when Venus then touches the opposite side of the Sun's rim, and the fourth timing is worked out when Venus has fully exited the Sun.
But in addition, they had to work out their position.
Latitude is fairly easy to measure. If you can measure the height of the midday sun at a particular day in the year, then you can calculate latitude. But longitude is very different. This was the big problem, finding the longitude of a ship as it crossed the oceans and went away from land. They could only do it by the stars. This was the big problem of that century. And it was solved not by the astronomers, but by the watchmakers and clockmakers.
And as the astronomers couldn't always determine their exact geographical position in relation to Greenwich, comparisons were problematic. And there was another difficulty. As telescopes became more powerful, a strange effect started to appear that further hindered the precision of their measurements.
Venus appears as a perfectly circular black disk on the face of the Sun. But when it hits the edge of the Sun, it doesn't suddenly break away. It pulls out into a teardrop. And it's just a refraction effect that causes this. But that really got the astronomers squabbling about the time of the exit and how long the transit took, because this little teardrop effect occurred.
So even observers who were standing next to each other were sometimes 20, 25 seconds apart from each other, which was, you know, for precise science like astronomy, really a disaster.
So the general feeling after the 1761 transit observations, that it had not been successful, that the accuracy that they wanted to achieve in measuring the distance from the Earth to the Sun had not been achieved. So there was renewed interest in planning for the following transit in 1769.
Venus of the South Seas, the transit of 1769. Sometimes scientific expeditions have unintended consequences. The desirability of observing the 1769 transit from the South Seas began a chain of events that would lead to the founding of the colony of New South Wales by the British in January 1788. James Cook used the lunar method of distances and became the first navigator to know his position at all times.
Captain Cook not only travelled with an astronomer, but he took his book of tables and the most sophisticated clocks, quadrants and reflecting telescopes of the day. And although we associate James Cook with the settlement of Australia, the main purpose of his voyage was to observe the transit of Venus on the island of Tahiti on the 3rd of June 1769.
This day proved as favourable to our purpose as we could wish. Not a cloud was to be seen the whole day, and the air was perfectly clear, so that we had every advantage we could desire in observing the whole of the passage of the planet Venus over the Sun's disk. We very distinctly saw an atmosphere or dusky shade round the body of the planet, which very much disturbed the times of the contacts, particularly the two internal ones. Dr. Solander observed, as well as Mr. Green and myself.
It was the main object, but after they'd left Tahiti, he had secret instructions to open. And those secret instructions told him to search for lands in the South Pacific, which, as we all know, he did very successfully.
There were many unintended consequences and fortuitous discoveries with these epic journeys. Another notable expedition was that of the 18th century Frenchman Jacques d'Autoroche. He not only covered 4,000 miles of Siberia in his quest to view the first 18th century transit, but according to Andrea Wolfe, he was one of the most dogged, managing to also view the following 1769 transit, but this time with fatal results.
He literally arrives in California like a week before the transit. So there's no time to find a good location for his observatory then. So there is such a kind of single-minded obsessiveness about it, which I just find extraordinary. He stops in a mission, but this mission is totally typhus-ridden. He sets up his instruments there, and he says, "Like, I don't care, you know, if typhus is raging in this mission. You know, I have no time to travel any further." He observes the transit, the second transit, very successfully, and then he dies. there of Typhus. So he dies in pursuit of seeing Venus, which actually quite a lot of astronomers, I mean, there are 5 astronomers who die on this quest.
From the 2 sets of transits, 1761 and 1769, the distance from the Earth to the Sun, the astronomical unit, was refined to within a few million kilometres. So it was quite reasonable. So by that stage, they did have a good handle on the scale of the solar system, distance of the planets, and they started having an idea of the universe, what kind of universe humanity had found itself. Prior to those transits, they really didn't have much of an idea.
Capturing the transit, 1874 and 1882. At 11:30 a.m. on December the 9th, 1874, a loud bell rang at Melbourne Observatory, signalling to the assembled observers that Venus was about to move onto the face of the Sun for the first time since Captain Cook had seen it 105 years earlier. Though the sky had been overcast all morning, and they were as yet uncertain if their endeavours were to be successful, the assembled observers all prepared for their tasks.
By the time of the 19th century pair of transits, a couple of big advances had occurred in technology. One was photography. Photography is a very big advance because it allowed the observations to be separated from the observer. There was an independent and permanent record made of the observations, whereas in the previous transits, the 18th century transits, you had to make an observation at a particular time and that was the only chance you got. Once you got photography, you could record that measurement. Other people could come back and look at your measurements that you'd made. You could come back at a future time and look at those measurements if perhaps you had a better theoretical understanding of what you were looking at.
And this hope that by taking photographs, the various optical effects, such as the black drop encountered in the 18th century, could be minimised.
The observers succeeded in taking at least 180 images of the Sun on at least 9 plates while Venus was entering or leaving.
Hundreds of thousands of people were now preparing to see the transit, compared to hundreds the century before, and only Jeremiah Horrocks and his friend William Crabtree before that. And due to advances in technology, the questions being asked were also changing, from philosophical to now scientific.
Technology had really moved on by the 19th century transits. One important piece of technology was the telegraph. This was the internet of the day. It was started being introduced from 1850s, 1860s onwards, and it was very useful because time could be transmitted from a central observatory to the observing site. Certainly by 1882, there would have been hundreds of thousands of people around the world who would have been watching the transit of Venus.
I think if you're watching any transit of Venus, part of you is always thinking about the next one because it's such a long way away, because it's a rhythmical event. It's like Halley's Comet. If you watch Halley's Comet, you know that's not going to happen again for another 75 years. So you're immediately, your thoughts turn to 75 years hence. And in fact, part of the paper that Horrocks wrote in 1639 and which became a sensation at the Royal Society was about posterity. You know, will we still be here when it comes back, and what will our children or our grandchildren think when they see it? So I think in some sense he was always looking forward to what it would be like, but I don't know if he would have predicted a technological change, because in a weird way it wasn't a technological thing to him, it was almost a philosophical thing about where we are in the universe and what is the nature of things. And the science that we're looking at with Horrocks is a science of kind of investigation of man, who we are, the nature of things. It's not a science that's particularly tied to the technology of like trying to do stuff better or see things more clearly.
The Space Age Transit, 2004. By the time of the next transit of Venus, the space age had arrived. In the intervening century, astronomers and scientists had accumulated a large body of knowledge relating to Venus and our solar system. Advances in technology meant that we were not only able to record the transit from space, but that hundreds of amateur astronomers could produce their own stunning photographs.
But at that time, 2004, nobody alive had seen a transit of Venus. It was interesting for the historical reasons. It was also interesting the fact that spacecraft observations showed us that the black drop was an inherent effect. We could understand why the previous results hadn't been so good. In fact, everybody back at that time had done the best they could. In fact, had done a great job. But they couldn't have done any better because there was nothing they could do about that black drop effect.
It was observed in different wavelengths for the first time. First time that people saw it in the red light of hydrogen atoms, in ultraviolet, in X-rays. So it was seen in a whole variety of different ways that it had not been seen in the past.
Also spectroscopy in the 1800s.
Spectroscopy is a very important part of modern astronomy. It's breaking the light from stars and galaxies and other distant objects into its components.
You take light from a star or an object, shine it through a glass prism, a triangular glass prism, and the light splits into the colours of the rainbow. By itself, that's probably not very useful, but if you look at starlight with this technique, you find that there are a series of dark lines superimposed across that spectrum or that rainbow, just like a barcode. And just like a barcode, you can use it to identify elements in the star. It can help you identify magnetic fields and whether the star is moving towards you or away from you. In fact, most of the information we get in astronomy comes through spectroscopy, not just looking at photographs of stars or other objects.
The world's highest resolution solar telescope obtained remarkably clear images of the 2004 transit.
Our modern way of determining distance between the Earth and Venus, and therefore scanning out the solar system, is to bounce radar beams off Venus by transmitting radar beams from very large radio telescopes on the Earth out to Venus and receiving a signal back. We can time how long it takes for that signal to travel out and back. We know that the radar beams are travelling at the speed of light. We can therefore work out very easily the distance between Venus and Earth. And then by using Kepler's laws, we know the ratio of the orbits of Earth and Venus, and we can work out the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and then go on to work out the distances to all the other planets, and then if we need to, the distances to stars and so on. The current value for the astronomical unit, which is the distance between the Earth and the Sun, is 149,597,870 kilometres and 700 metres, and that's accurate to 3 metres.
It was all really looking backwards in 2004. Now, what to me is very, very exciting, that in 2012 the situation is very different.
Observing the 2012 transit. The last transit of Venus for the 21st century, and the last anybody now living is likely to see, will take place on the 5th or 6th of June, depending on where it is being observed from. The entire transit will be visible from Eastern Australia, New Zealand, and parts of Asia. Most other areas of the world will see part of the transit.
It's very hard not to know about the 2012 transit. In previous years, in 2004, it was very well known about. In previous centuries, though, there was only a limited group of people who were either interested or actually got to observe the transit. But now it's a very, very big event, both for its historical meaning and just because it's a good spectacle for people to get out and see.
In 2012, astronomers actually looking at the transit of Venus to do research, cutting-edge research in astronomy. So the situation has changed very much just in the 8 years.
We've now been using spacecraft to look at transits of planets around other stars elsewhere in our galaxy. Some of those planets will have atmospheres around them, and one of the big things we'd like to do is analyse those atmospheres. By using spectroscopy, we hope to identify the elements and the compounds in those atmospheres. If we can see our present transit of Venus with a spectrograph, we could get some clues about how the atmosphere of Venus affects our view of a planetary transit, and we could apply that new knowledge to these transits of planets around other stars, and that would help us understand these planets and their atmospheres out there in the galaxy.
A regularly repeating dip in the brightness of a star indicates to scientists on the ground the possibility of a planet circling a star.
The Kepler spacecraft, which spends all its time staring at one particular direction in space, and it's looking for stars which dim their light by a very tiny amount for a short period of time. And these dimmings are due to planets passing in front of the star, just like Venus passing in front of the Sun during a transit of Venus. And by observing a transit of Venus, we can actually see how to glean the maximum amount of information from the transit of looking at distant stars.
This is Houston, contact with a test. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And in the past, the measurements were only done by astronomers. But now, everyone can participate in this transit.
There's an app being developed for smartphones that allow anybody with a smartphone, if they can get to observe the transit, to report their observations in a way that was not possible even in 2004.
The technology of a smartphone was barely thought about 8 years ago. You can now download the Transit of Venus app, determine your exact position and Greenwich Mean Time, record the event, and then send it to a central location for processing, all in three clicks.
Extraordinary things have happened in communications technology. Unbelievable things. Things that even within a heartbeat. I was talking to my son about this the other day, and my son is 21, so he's the Harry Potter generation. And he said that when he read the first Harry Potter book, there's this thing in it where there's a map where you can see yourself. And he thought, that is a really cool piece of magic. And in fact, I've got that on my iPhone.
The next transit will be on the 11th of December 2117. Just like in 1874, 1882, they had no idea what the science would be like at the beginning of the 21st century. So what it will be in the beginning of the 22nd. Maybe lots of tourists will be up in space and observing the transit from space. They will not have to be worried about clouds happening on Earth.
With all the benefits of technology and so on that we've had, and the advances that we've made over the years, there's still one thing that we simply can't control, and that's the weather. And if it turns out to be cloudy, you won't get to see it, no matter what your technology is.
It was the 24th of November, 1639, and the day was cloudy. Jeremiah Horrocks certainly knew he wouldn't get another chance to see the transit because they're so widely spread. And then at 3:15, the cloud cleared, and he'd set up a telescope, which he'd bought for 2 and 6 pence, which was a huge amount of money. And he'd set up a telescope on a stand, projecting onto a piece of cloth, and then he saw the disk of the sun appear on the cloth and a tiny, tiny black dot moving across it. And for half an hour, he watched that. And that half an hour is something that I'm always thinking about, when the clouds parted. And he said, the clouds, as if by divine interposition, were entirely dispersed, and I was invited to the grateful task of repeating my observations. And I then beheld the agreeable spectacle, the object of my sanguine wishes.
I then beheld a most agreeable spectacle, the object of my sanguine wishes. I could scarcely have wished for a more extended period.
I could scarcely have wished for a more extended period. It's beautiful. Beautiful little story. What I find kind of amazing about it is that he is it's a Copernican moment, you know, because Copernicus's thing is that we're not the center of the universe. So this sort of proves that we're not physically the center of the universe. To me, it's like Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, that moment. You know, he's stepping into a new world.
Sitting once wrapped with delight.
For Horrocks, he really thought God was speaking to him, that the cosmos was speaking to him, the whole universe was concentrated on this moment for Jeremiah Horrocks's head. This piece of information was being given to him.
In Capturing Venus, you heard the curator of astronomy for Sydney Observatory and the Powerhouse Museum, Nick Lom, the writer and historian, Andrea Wolfe, historian Peter Orton, the writer, Frank Cottrell Boyce, and assistant curator of astronomy at Sydney Observatory, Andrew Jacobs. The reader was Alice Parkinson. The excerpts were from Nick Lom's book, Transit of Venus. The sound engineer was Judy Rapley and our producer is Ros Blewett. For more information about the program, you can go to our webpage, abc.net.au/radionational, and follow the links to Hindsight. And in a moment, some religious reflection on the night sky with the Benedictine monks at New Norcia in WA. You're with Hindsight here on RN Summer. Today's program is all about the celestial and its enduring impact on our lives. The connection between religious thought and science wasn't only a 17th century preoccupation. A few years ago, scientists from the European Space Agency were looking for a quiet place on the outskirts of Perth in Western Australia to locate their new antenna. The nearby land of the monastery at New Norcia was perfect. So the Benedictine monks and the astrophysicists collaborated in the establishment of the space station. They found common ground and they made lasting friendships. Curious to know more about what they were searching for, Ros Blewett visited these two very different groups of men.
You know, so this is Ron.
Hi, Ron, it's Ros.
Okay, come in, please.
This is the main equipment room, as we call it, which is the main control room where we can operate the whole station from the console. As we have Brett sitting over here. We're manned 24 hours a day. We have security guards when we're not on site. First attendance to site is usually make contact with the operations centre in Germany to find out if there are any problems during the day or during the night when we weren't on site, and if there's anything that requires attention immediately.
Network New Norcia.
We're seeking out, or the European Space Agency particularly seeking out, you know, the life on other planets and the origin of the universe. This morning they're tracking the Rosetta spacecraft, which is going off to a comet, roughly 900 million kilometres away. It's about a 10-year mission to get there, and a couple of years while it's there to do some work. Rosetta is basically breaking new ground. It's also travelling a long way to get there. I mean, Rosetta's in transit. It's on its way to the comet. Mars Express, for instance, is travelling around Mars, and all it is collecting more information that they can put it all together and come up with maybe different theories, different concepts.
If you could give us a count back, please.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10, 7. This is a beautiful morning, and tomorrow will be the same.
Copy that, thank you. Ours is very much the same over here. I'll just give you I read your 5x5 anyway, and I'll give you a count back. If you can follow the line from the satellite dish up, that's where Mars is. Basically, from where we're looking here, we're just looking over green paddocks quite a lot of sheep in the paddock there from the local farmer. We're surrounded by farmland. Unfortunately, you can't see the monastery. It's tucked over the hills just a little bit out to the way.
Yeah, I was delighted with the chance of collaborating in whatever way we could with space exploration. I think it's a magnificent quest, and the more truth we can find out about this world, the better for everybody. Aristotle has a very famous opening sentence to the metaphysics that every human being desires to know. I think that's the foundation of all scientific exploration, of all systematic thinking in any field, including religion.
People are often amazed that we have a space station so near the monastery and that we get on so well with the people from the space station.
It's a very beautiful object because it's set against the sky.
All these scientific formulas, all this quest for knowledge was really based in the search for God.
Pythagoras painted a picture in which the universe was conceived as a great musical instrument resonating with divine mathematical harmonies. By contemplating numbers and their relationships, the Pythagoreans sought union with the divine. For them, mathematics was first and foremost a religious activity.
It's always with you, isn't it, the background?
It's continuous, yeah. We're sending our single probe, basically, out into a vast noise or vast space, trying to find that one little bit of information that, which is the primary goal of our mission. I guess any signal is really noise. It depends. If it's your radio signal, then it's not noise. But if it's not your radio signal, it's everyone else, it's just noise. So I guess everything we receive could be something. It's just a matter of what you can do with it as the person that wants the information. We know what we're after. We have a satellite in space that's transmitting a particular signal on a particular frequency. So we're not interested in the other information that we're receiving, even though we could seriously be receiving other information. So we simply remove that and just use the bit that we're expecting. It's a never-ending story. I mean, I guess that's what the answers are being asked, you know. Where is the edge of it all? Where are the new planets? And are there other solar systems like ours sustaining life, for that matter? Rosetta's basically going to the extremes. A little bit more involved to get hold of something that's out in the middle of nowhere, but yes.
With nowhere, is that...
This is a big argument. What's deep space? I don't know how you define deep space. This is a big argument that many people have had. People from the Perth Astronomy Society and the Perth Observatory out here, and we mentioned the word deep space and got lots of arguments. That's the argument, I guess. How far can you keep going? You'd imagine there'd have to be an end, but maybe there's not. I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever find out either.
They sit, they walk among the ruins, but no idle talk is heard. To grave demeanour all are bound. And from one voice a hymn with tuneful sound hallows once more the long deserted choir and thrills the old sepulchral earth around.
Alleluia.
I don't know if you've noticed the stars here at night, but they're just incredible. I've been here for 10 years now, and I'm still amazed by them. I've never seen stars like it.
And anybody who looks into the sky, I think, with any kind of humility or sympathy, I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for, will feel inspired by the infinite mysteries beyond all our knowledge, which we can go on exploring and finding out more and more about. But the more we find out, the more there is to find out.
Hildegard of Bingen referred to the stars, you know, a lot, in quite a nice way, actually, that all these stars were somehow being emptied out. There's millions and millions of them, and in her vision, she saw those stars as being emptied out so that when we move on from this world, we fill them. So we return to that place from where we came, which is, her idea was that everything belongs. Humanity belongs to something much, much greater than its own understanding of itself, which is the whole cosmos, the whole of creation.
It looks quite interesting here. Kel, come over and see what you think of this.
Oh, that does look more interesting.
Shall we take it off to the source and see if it disappears?
Yeah, let's do an integration off source, see if it goes away.
Right.
Yeah, right. Why don't you move it in?
Oh, it's coming up again.
It's about the best one we've had.
An excerpt from New Norcia, The Monastery and the Observatory, produced by Ros Bluett and Russell Stapleton. The recordings were made on location at the Benedictine Monastery in New Norcia, Western Australia, and at the European Space Station just down the road. Next week on Hindsight, the story of Neville Bonner, Australia's first black parliamentarian and a study in contradictions. I'm Lorena Allam. Do enjoy your afternoon here on RN Summer, and Happy New Year to you. The news is next.